Well, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. You've all gone quiet, so I thought I'd leap into the breach and say a few things. My name is Andrew Gowdy. I'm the master of St. Cross, and St. Cross is the college which is sponsoring this lecture this evening. So let me welcome you all here, some 500 of you, and offer a special welcome to our speaker, Professor Michio Kaku. Now, I just want to say a few words about St. Cross, the best-kept secret in the university. We are, by Oxford standards, a new college, established in 1965, and we are a poor college by anyone's standards. I'm talking here financially, but the college is notable for the fact that it's egalitarian. We don't have a high table, but we have high chairs. We're multidisciplinary. We're not a one-trick pony like some of the graduate colleges. And we have something like 100 fellows from all sorts of disciplines and something like 400 graduate students. And in governing body, with nothing better to do, we try to think up some sort of motto for the college, which is global engagements and global conversations. And by that I mean the college is interested in the big issues of the day, things like global health and China and global warming, but is also interested in the big intellectual concerns of the day. And these issues and concerns benefit from a multidisciplinary environment such as St. Cross provides, and with which today's lecture ties in so admirably. I'm very grateful to one of our fellows, Joe Ashbourne, sitting in the front here, for helping to organise this lecture. And I am delighted to say, because it means I can sit down and relax and enjoy the talk, that Professor Peter Atkins has agreed to chair the lecture and the following discussion. Now, Peter is a fellow of Lincoln College, a hugely famous chemist, and, like our speaker, a major contributor to the public understanding of science. So, Peter, may I hand over to you? Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. It's a real privilege to be able to make this introduction this evening, and I will not spend much time over it. But first of all, the facts as far as I understand them. Dr. Kaku was born in California immediately after the Second World War, and that must have been a terribly difficult time. But after that, the path was golden, since it led first of all to Harvard, then to Berkeley, then to Princeton, and as you see, finally, to Oxford. At the moment, of course, his day job, such as it is professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York. His research interests are string theory, and he is the founder of a particular branch of that theory. It might not, of course, even be a theory. It might not even be physics, but we will have to see whether that turns out to be the case. And happily, it provides around 11 dimensions. And Dr. Kaku needs all those 11 dimensions for what he does when he's not doing his day job, because he is one of the United States' premier communicators of science, has television shows, has a weekly radio call-in program, and writes columns. And so he is extraordinarily busy, and I think we're particularly delighted that you can spare the time to promote your latest book. And that book, of course, has had delighted reviews, the ones that I've read. And I'm sure you will hear about the various classes of impossibility as the evening unfolds. I will perhaps add one class of impossibility, class zero, if I can coin it, which is impossibilities of the past, which have proved to have come to pass. And I have several thoughts about those. One, of course, is the prediction that it is impossible for man to fly. Another is that it will be impossible for the human body to exceed 60 miles per hour. And if we look at what the government currently plans, we can see that that might, in fact, also be true when the speed limit is imposed on us all. And my favourite one, is, which I think epitomises the attitudes of philosophers, is the remark by Auguste Comte that although we may see the stars, never by any stretch of the imagination will we know their composition. That, to me, seems to be the mark of a philosopher. Deeply pessimistic, in contrast to the splendid optimism that a scientist should represent. And I think we shall hear some of that optimism this evening. And a remark on your website refers to you as the superhero of the incomprehensible. That, of course, can be taken two ways, but I'm sure that this evening, as you unfold your story, we will see the sparkle, which is your reputation. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. After such a great introduction, I can't wait to hear the speaker myself. Let me say, first of all, that today I'm going to take you on a guided tour of the impossible. I'm going to take you into the future. And of course, it's always dangerous to make predictions about the future. I quote from that great philosopher of the Western world, the baseball player Yogi Berra. Yogi Berra once said, quote, "Prediction is awfully hard to do, especially if it's about the future." Well, I'm a physicist. We are the ones who invented the laser. We invented the transistor. We helped to create the electronic computer. We helped create the internet. We wrote the World Wide Web. We created the MRI machine. We created the CAT scan, the X-ray scan, radio, television, microwaves, almost everything you see around you, a physicist helped to initiate. And we like to make predictions. Well, when we helped to get the internet off the ground, one physicist made a prediction. He predicted that the internet would become a forum of high culture, high art, and high society. Well, today we know that 5% of the internet is pornography. But that's because teenage boys log on to the internet. Just wait till the grandmas and grandpas log on to the internet. Then 50% of the internet will be pornography. And let me tell you a story about the limitations of physics. Over 200 years ago, we had the great French Revolution. And one day, there were three gentlemen about to have their heads cut off at the guillotine. There was a priest, there was a barrister, and a theoretical physicist, just like me, about to lose our head to the guillotine. Well, they put the priest's head on the chopping block, and they asked him, "Do you have any last words before we slice your head off?" And the priest said, "Yes." He said, God from above shall show mercy and set me free." Well, the mob said, "Impossible, impossible. Hundreds of heads have fallen. God has shown no mercy for the rich." Well, they raised the blade. All eyes were on the blade. The blade came down, swoosh, and stopped right before it hit the neck of the priest. Well, the mob was just delirious. The impossible had happened. "Let him go," they shouted. "God has spoken today." And then they put the barrister's head on the chopping block, and they asked him, "Do you have any final words before we chop your head off?" And he said, "Yes, maybe the spirit of justice. Yes, justice shall set me free." Well, all eyes were on the blade. The blade rose and fell, swish, and stopped right before it hit the neck of the barrister. Well, this time the crowd went crazy. They said, let there be a national holiday. Let there be dancing in the streets. The impossible has happened twice. And now let's see about that theoretical physicist. Well, yes, they put the physicist's head on the chopping block. And they asked him, do you have any last words before we slice your head off? And the physicist said, yeah, I got some last words. And he said, you know, I don't know too much about God. And I know even less about the law. But I do know one thing. If you look up, you'll see that the rope is stuck on the pulley. And then he said, if you remove the rope, the blade should come down real good. Big mistake. The rope came down, the blade came down, and the poor physicist's head came down. And it just goes to show you that sometimes we physicists have to know when to keep our mouths shut, okay? Nonetheless, let me say a few things about how I got interested in science fiction. Most scientists don't want to admit this, but yeah, we are inspired by science fiction. For example, there was a young gentleman here who came to Oxford University on a Rhodes Scholarship from the United States. His name was Edwin Hubble, a country farm boy learning law here at Oxford University. He went back to Missouri and had a promising career as a lawyer, but he still remembered the excitement that he felt as a child reading Jules Verne. In the middle of a promising career, he dropped all his legal work, went to the University of Chicago, learned, got a PhD in astrophysics, and went on to become the greatest astronomer of the 20th century. He discovered the expanding universe. And if the universe expands and you run the videotape backwards, you get Genesis. Not bad for science fiction. When I was a kid, I used to watch the old Flash Gordon series on TV. I mean, I was hooked. I mean, ray guns, starships, invisibility machines, city in the sky. And then I figured out something. I figured out a few lessons of life. First, I didn't have blonde hair and muscles. That was a big disappointment when I figured that one out. But then I realized that it was a scientist, the physicist, who invented the starship. He invented the invisibility shield. He created the city in the sky. And I said to myself, hey, that's for me. But what kind of science should I go into? Well, when I was a child, I'll never forget this. One day the teacher walked into the room and announced to the whole class that everyone was talking about the fact, it was front page news, that a great scientist had just died. Everyone was talking about this scientist. And I'll never forget this. The evening news that night, they flashed a picture of his desk, and the caption said, unfinished manuscript of the greatest unfinished work of the greatest scientist of our time. That scientist was Albert Einstein. And I spent years trying to reconstruct what was in that book. What could be so hard that the greatest mind of our time could not finish? Later, I realized that it was to be the theory of everything. This was greater than any murder mystery, greater than any adventure story. I had to know what was in that book. Why did he get stuck? Why couldn't he finish the greatest manuscript of his time? Well, today we think we have it, and we're going to test it starting this October. The theory is called string theory. It is a theory, it is physics, and this October, we hope to initiate the first tests of a theory of everything. But I was still a child, learning about the wonders of science for the first time. I wanted to be part of this revolution. So one day, I went to my mom, and I said, Mom, can I have permission to build an atom smasher in the garage? A 2.3 million electron volt betatron particle accelerator, to be precise. Can I do that, Mom? My mom kind of stared at me, and she said, sure, why not? And don't forget to take out the garbage. Well, I took out the garbage, and I went to Westinghouse, and I got 400 pounds of transformer steel. I bought 22 miles of copper wire that we wound on the football field over Christmas. It consumed 6 kilowatts of power. Created a magnetic field of 10,000 Gauss, that's 20,000 times your magnetic field. If you were to walk by my atom smasher, it would pull the fillings out of your teeth. It consumed 6 kilowatts of power. One day, it was finished. I closed my eyes. I shut my ears. I plugged it into the wall socket. And I heard 6 kilowatts of power surging through the capacitor bank. And just as it was revving up, I heard this pop, 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 pop sound as I blew out all the fuses in the house. And the whole house was plunged in darkness. You know, my poor mom, she'd come home from work, hard day's work, see the lights flicker and die. And then she must have said, why couldn't I have a son who plays baseball? Maybe if I buy him a basketball. And for God's sake, why can't he find a nice Japanese girlfriend? I mean, why does he have to build these machines in the garage? Well, that machine took me to the National Science Fair, where I met a scientist who took an interest in me. His name was Edward Teller, father of the hydrogen bomb. And he arranged for me to get a scholarship to Harvard. Later, after I graduated from Harvard, he made a big pitch for me to design hydrogen warheads. But you know, I said no. I didn't want to work on hydrogen warheads. In fact, in some sense, I wanted to work on a bigger explosion, and that is Genesis. And that's what we're going to talk about today, the impossible. We're going to talk about opening up the world of science fiction. Phasers, force fields, time machines, warp drive, which are impossible and which are not possible. Well, it was mentioned by the previous speaker that once upon a time, airplanes were thought to be impossible. Well, here's the man who said it, Lord Kelvin, the greatest Victorian physicist of his time. The Kelvin scale is named after him, the most celebrated physicist of his era during the Victorian time. Unfortunately, he's known to historians for making a series of predictions, each one wrong. First, airplanes. Ha, he said. Heavier than aircraft? Impossible, said Lord Kelvin. X-rays? Nonsense, he said. Of course, X-rays are a hoax. Whoever heard of penetrating rays? A hoax. Radio, he said. Of what possible use could radio have? Maybe to communicate with a merchant fleet off the coast of London. Other than that, radio had no purpose. And the Earth? It was impossible that the Earth could be more than just a million or so years old. Well, what happened? Well, first of all, it was also the philosopher Auguste Comte. It was mentioned that even philosophers said that there are impossible things. We'll never know what the stars are made out of. That was made by the French philosopher Auguste Comte. He said, science is very powerful. We have discovered many things. But one thing we will never know, he said, and that is what the stars are made of. A few years after that, Fraunhofer said, hydrogen. By looking at echoes from the sun, starlight through a spectrograph, Fraunhofer and others identified hydrogen. So what went wrong? What went wrong is that Lord Kelvin had the unfortunate coincidence of living just before Albert Einstein and Niels Bohr and the quantum theory. They have changed everything. Relativity gives us a theory of the very big, black holes, expanding universes. The quantum theory gives us a theory of the very small, atoms and laser beams and MRI scans. And these two theories allow us to make predictions into the future, because we now have a theory of almost everything, a theory of relativity and a theory of the quantum theory. And next, we want to get a theory of everything. And the leading and only candidate for this is string theory. Some people say, well, professor, I don't like string theory. Give me an alternative. Well, there is none. It's the only game in town. Anyway, let's move on to the impossible. In the 1930s, this is Robert Goddard. He was spit upon by many editorial writers. Rockets. Ha! Rockets! The New York Times said that it is impossible to send rockets into outer space because, quote, there's no air to push against in outer space. Well, rockets don't need air to push against. They just need Newton's third law of motion, action, reaction. Now we know that the only hot air was in the editorial office of the New York Times. So it's always dangerous to say something is impossible. So I like to quote instead the three laws of impossibility of Arthur C. Clarke. My favorite law is the third one. I fondly remember this every day. The third law says, quote, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about the magic of Harry Potter, the magic of Flash Gordon, the magic of Star Wars, the magic of the Terminator in the language of relativity and the quantum theory. So let's begin. Three classes of impossibility. Sometimes when you tell a scientist that something is impossible, they say, well, that's it, it's impossible. But impossibility is relative. First of all, most of what you see on the silver screen, about 80% of what you think is impossible, actually conforms to the laws of physics. Ray guns, force fields, invisibility, certain forms of teleportation, starships, antimatter engines, telepathy, artificial intelligence. They're class one, meaning that we will have them in a few years, a few decades to a century. And if you don't believe it, we're taking a film crew to film these things. I recently signed a contract with the Science Channel and ITV Television, and we're now taking every chapter of the book and making a 12-episode TV series to air this fall. Just last week, we photographed on TV cameras the first, well, not the first, but teleportation of atoms. We can now teleport, just like in Star Trek, ytterbium atoms, and we actually filmed it last week for the TV program. Class two impossibilities are farther down the line. They're at the border of what we know, time machines, warp drive, interdimensional travel. They're at the very border of what we think is possible. But yeah, we think they're possible. And class three is, well, they simply violate relativity and the quantum theory. Perpetual motion machines, getting something for nothing. The Wall Street Journal many times covers the work of an inventor who promises free energy and cons millions of dollars from inventors. And the Wall Street Journal wants a quote, so they call me on the telephone, and I quote from that other great philosopher of the Western world, P.T. Barnum, who once said, quote, there's a sucker born every minute. So let's now talk about magic, the magic of impossibility. You know, I used to teach optics at the university, and one of the first things I would tell my students is that invisibility is impossible. It's impossible for the index of refraction to be less than zero. Every physics textbook in optics more or less says that fact. Well, I was wrong. And so was every single physics textbook in the world. 3 years ago, we showed that microwave radiation will, in fact, bend backwards. And just this year, we took a film crew to Berkeley, California, where I got my PhD, and filmed invisibility experiments. Let's now have the first video. We're now going to go to Duke University, where, compliments of BBC Television, we're now going to photograph the impossible. Invisibility, once thought to violate Maxwell's equations. Here it is. Can we reduce the lights a little bit? Yeah.
What we've done is to take materials that are commonly found, something like copper and plastic, which is what our circuit board materials are made out of, and we've placed patterns in the copper so that they're tiny circuits. And these circuits act as artificial atoms in a regular material, except now we've made an artificial material.
And this altered material has a unique property. It can bend electromagnetic radiation around itself, making it invisible to microwaves. The lime green waves are microwaves. When an ordinary copper ring is placed in their path, the waves are disturbed. But when the metamaterial is placed there, the waves bend around it and seamlessly merge on the other side, as if there was nothing there.
And the invisibility cloak is something that's entirely new. It's a structure that doesn't exist in nature, something that couldn't be fashioned out of existing materials, and something that really functions in an almost science fiction-y way that you might imagine wouldn't have been possible just a few years ago. We've demonstrated the principle of invisibility at microwave frequencies. And microwave frequencies are a few centimeters in size, or at least maybe the size of your thumb. So now we're looking into the future and whether or not we can do this invisible light.
In addition to microwaves, scientists have already succeeded in bending red and blue light. Full invisibility may be just decades away.
the first applications are likely to be for military stealth. But it's hard to imagine we'll stop there. The ancients have always been fascinated by the property of invisibility. Over 2,000 years ago, Plato refers to this story. Once there was a poor shepherd who finds a cave, and inside the cave there's a ring of invisibility. And he uses that ring to sneak into the king's castle, seduce the queen, plot against the king. He killed the king and became the next monarch. Well, Plato used that story to show that invisibility is so powerful, it could cause societies to disintegrate. So even Plato was fascinated by the implications of invisibility. Well, we will have it in the coming years, but there are many hurdles that have to be breached. One hurdle is that if you're inside the invisibility cloak, you cannot look outside. You have to drill two holes in it. So from the outside, you see two eyeballs floating in midair. Like this. Also, for visible light, we've done it, however, at a microscopic scale. We want to make sure that we can make large objects invisible as well, and that is the next step. So just realize that just a few years ago, every physics textbook in optics said this is impossible, and yet now it's coming to be. Now, something else that is impossible is teleportation. Well, first of all, let me explain how it works. This is how it works. If water hits a boulder, it wraps around the boulder, reforms at the other end. So if you're downstream from a boulder, you don't know there's a boulder upstream. This is the same thing for light. Light cannot do this, we once thought. We have theorems showing that light cannot behave this way. But now we've created metamaterials where light exactly behaves like this. And as I mentioned, we filmed it, so you'll actually see it on TV, the very fact that optics is stranger than we thought. And now let's talk about something even more bizarre than invisibility, and that is teleportation. Is it possible to zap your molecules across a room? Well, at one point, we thought that was impossible. There are many physics books that say flatly that teleportation is impossible. Well, 10 years ago, we did it. We did it for particles of light called photons, and now we teleport atoms. In fact, last week, we actually photographed for the TV camera an atom being teleported right across the room. Now, a photon is a particle of light. So whenever I watch Star Trek and Captain Kirk says, "Fire the photon torpedoes," I laugh because a photon torpedo is a flashlight. So let's now go to the University of Vienna in Austria and talk to Professor Zeilinger, the physicist who did the impossible and his dreams for the future. Let's now have the second video, and we're now going to go to Vienna. The people there hold the world's record for teleporting a photon 600 meters. Next, they want to teleport to the space shuttle.
Here in Vienna, one of the most fantastic concepts of science fiction has already been turned into reality. And in fact, it may represent our ultimate mastery over matter itself. It's called teleportation.
In my group, we have achieved teleportation 10 years ago. And we are doing it on a regular basis, all the time, improving, adding new things and so on. So it's a simple fact. Teleportation exists.
This is the world's first teleportation machine. With it, Professor Anton Zeilinger and his team are teleporting individual particles of light, called photons, from one prism to another. And it can happen over any distance.
The present record about distance in teleportation is 600 meters. This was done by our group from one side of the river Danube over to another side. But there are no limits. I mean, we might do it someday to the moon or to Mars or who knows.
Professor Zeilinger is inducing a peculiar state in his particles of light. It's called quantum entanglement. It's a mysterious bond between a pair of photons. When you change one, the other changes instantly. So the photon itself isn't teleported, just the information it contains.
What we really teleport in quantum teleportation is the information carried by a system. This information is teleported over to another system, which assumes exactly that information, therefore it becomes identical with the original. The original loses its properties, and the new one is made up of different matter. It's not the same matter as the original.
What's interesting is that the original photon's information is lost, which could have huge implications for teleporting anything on a larger scale.
Is it out of the question? Or is it just very, very difficult to teleport a dog, a cat, or a human?
Well, we can dream, and if we dream about teleportation of humans, then all kinds of questions arise, like, what does it mean to be me? When someone teleports me, and I know that what is being teleported is information and not matter, not the stuff I'm made of, who is it who ends up over there?
How does an average person react to the fact that you have to be destroyed in order to be have your state teleported?
Suppose we put an ad in the newspaper, just for fun. Mm-hmm. Just for fun, we put an ad in the newspaper which says that we want to try teleportation of people and we look for volunteers. Oh. But we cannot guarantee that it will be successful 100%, maybe only 10 or 20%. I bet many people would show up and want to be the first one to be teleported, even if it might not succeed. You know?
In the next few years, scientists will teleport the first simple molecule, then complex molecules, perhaps the first virus within a decade or so. Teleporting a human may seem impossibly advanced, but science is changing our world faster than it has ever done in human.
So we've teleported photons, we've teleported atoms, we filmed an atom being teleported for our TV cameras just last week. We will eventually teleport molecules in this decade, maybe a gene, DNA, maybe a virus, maybe even a cell. A human, of course, consists of 50 trillion cells, and that may take time, but Star Trek takes place in the 23rd century. Now, Anton asked me a question. Would I be willing to be the first man to be teleported? And I said, Anton, I will be the second man to be teleported. So, moving on, these are class one impossibilities, but something like the Death Star. Some people say, give me a break. We love the movie Star Wars, but something that could blow up an entire planet? No way. Well, actually, this is possible. As I mentioned, Edward Teller offered me a job designing hydrogen warheads. It turns out there's no limit to the amount of energy you can put on a laser beam. There is no limit to the amount of energy you can put on an atomic bomb. And in fact, Mother Nature creates the Death Stars in outer space. These are gamma ray bursters, the largest explosion since the Big Bang itself. Briefly, one of these gamma ray bursters will outshine the entire universe. Let me say that again. Briefly, one of these exploding stars will actually outshine the entire known universe. It emits a huge pulse of radiation through the North Pole and the South Pole. Any solar system like Alderaan in the path of this will be blown apart. So what planet is in the gun barrel of a gamma ray burster? And the answer is us. This is WR104. Type it into Google tonight. WR104. It is an unstable double star system that we are tracking very carefully because we are staring down the gun barrel of a potential exploding star. It is 8,000 light years from Earth. A gamma ray burster can easily go across 8,000 light years. Maybe 8,000 years ago, it already blew up.
So tomorrow, you're doing your laundry. Tomorrow, you're studying for a final exam. And you look up, and the sky is on fire. Well, is that possible? Well, the answer is yes. However, most astronomers say, well, 8,000 light years is a good hefty distance. Maybe it'll be a dud. Who knows? All I can say is that we're monitoring it very carefully. And yeah, there is a potential gamma ray burster. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when, that will one day blow up. And let's just hope that it misses, or let's hope it's a dud. Now let's talk about mind reading. Some people say, well, you know, gee, physics does a lot of interesting things, but my thoughts are private. I cannot control anything with my mind. Well, listen up. Telepathy is now on the agenda. In fact, it's one of the fastest growing fields in science right now. This is Brown University. This gentleman here on the lower right had a stroke. He is paralyzed. He cannot communicate with his parents. On the lower left, you see a little red dot. That's where we put an electrode right in his brain. We connected the electrode to a laptop computer, and after a few hours of work, it's like riding a bicycle, he got accustomed to moving the cursor on the laptop screen. This person is paralyzed. He can now surf the web. He can answer emails. He can write emails. He can now do crossword puzzles, and he can now surf the web, and he cannot move a finger. In the future, perhaps you will be wired not like this, but with a microscopic cable. You will surf the web just by thinking about it. Wouldn't that be great during final examinations? No one knows you're surfing the web, surfing for all the answers in the entire database of the planet Earth, taking your final examination. But not only can you project your thoughts, not only in the future, maybe you'll surf the web by thinking about it, we can actually begin to read thoughts as well. When you tell the truth, your brain scan lights up a little bit, shown here. But when you tell a lie, your brain lights up like a Christmas tree. Because first you have to know the truth, and then you have to invent the cover-up, and then you have to understand the consequences of the cover-up and the consistency of the cover-up with all the other lies you've been telling all these years. That's a lot of brain power there. It lights like a Christmas tree. And in the upper right, we can even see the beginning of a dictionary of thought. When you think of a dog or a cat, it lights up a characteristic pattern, dog, cat, animal, house, and we could read about 20 words with reasonable accuracy. In the future, perhaps we'll be able to have a dictionary of a few hundred words, in which case we'll be able to pull together ideas that you are thinking about by simply reading them on an MRI scan. Now, computer technology is even so advanced that we can now put the entire internet on your contact lens. This is the future of the internet. The internet on your contact lens. So when you put on your contact lenses in the future, you will go online. This is the future of your entertainment center, home entertainment center, the future of your home office, and this is how you will take final examinations in the future, by scanning the web via your contact lenses. These contact lenses will also recognize people's faces with 98% accuracy on pre-programmed faces. Let's say you bump into another student at a dance or a conference and you say, who is this person? I know this person. Jim, John, Jake, who is this person? In the future, your contact lenses will say, it's Jim, stupid, remember? You met him at last week's party. You want to see his entire biography, his entire history in the contact lenses of your glasses? And let's say you're looking for a job. Here you are at a cocktail party, famous, wealthy people, powerful people at a cocktail party, but you don't know who to talk to. In the future, you'll know exactly who to suck up to at any cocktail party. These chips are so great that we're putting them in toys now. Toys are becoming intelligent, and this is creating a problem for the English language, a contradiction in terms called smart Barbie dolls. Another contradiction in terms is Microsoft works. And these chips are so powerful, we're putting them in aspirin pills now. I have a photograph, I didn't bring it here today, of an aspirin pill with a PC inside, a chip, and a TV camera. You swallow it, it photographs all the insides of your body without cutting your skin at all. This gives new meaning for the expression Intel inside. Now let's talk about starships. Wouldn't it be great if we could one day blast off into outer space and roam the stars? Well, believe it or not, we went to Cleveland, Ohio with our film crew and filmed the scientists who are dreaming of one day building the first starship. This is a solar sail. We think that solar cells may begin to reach some of the outer planets. Another possibility is the way they did it in the movie 2001. How many people here have seen the movie 2001? Raise your hand. Most of you. How many people have understood that movie? Raise your hand. Let me tell you what the meaning of 2001 is. At the beginning of the movie, Kubrick interviews astrophysicists about what is the best way to explore the galaxy. There must be billions of stars out there. You can't send Captain Kirk visiting each planet. That's the stupidest way to explore the galaxy. No, the best way to explore the galaxy is the same way that a virus colonizes your body. A virus is a molecule, a very complicated molecule, but one virus in principle can give you a cold. You consist of 50 trillion cells. How does that work? A virus lands on a cell, hijacks the machinery of the cell, and creates hundreds of copies of itself. Each virus then lands on another cell. Each one creates hundreds more copies of itself. Starting with one virus, you have 100, then 100 times 100, then 100 times 100 times 100, then 100 times 100 times 100 times 100, and in 2 weeks, you're sneezing. Well, on the upper right is your virus. That monolith lands on the moon. The moon is stable. It has no erosion, very stable, and it hijacks the soil to make copies of itself. You saw that scene in the movie where there are millions of these things floating around Jupiter. You saw that scene. Well, these things then land on other moons, these copies. So starting with one monolith, you have a million, then a million million, until finally you have a sphere expanding at the speed of light containing trillions of these things colonizing the galaxy. This means that on our moon, there could be, I'm not saying there is, there could be evidence of a previous visitation. If we have been visited by aliens from outer space, mathematically, the most likely place for a visitation is our moon. And how long will it take before we are smart enough to figure that out? Another 100 years. So 2001 was off by 100 years. That movie should have been called 2101. That's when we have an operating moon base capable of finding a previous visitation monolith like this. Nuclear is a possibility. These are ramjet fusion engines that gobble up hydrogen in the forward direction. These run forever. They simply scoop up intergalactic hydrogen gas. Now let's say a few things about Terminator. The movie is about to come out. Some people think, oh my God, robots are just around the corner. They're going to become smarter than us. They're going to put us in zoos. They'll make us dance behind bars. They'll throw peanuts at us, just like we make you-know-what dance behind bars. Well, maybe that's going to happen to us. Well, how smart are robots? To find the answer, I went to Tokyo with BBC Television, and we're now going to go to the third video where we will talk to the world's most advanced robot, Asimo. How smart is Asimo? And well, one day, will Asimo become a Terminator?
The Japanese people conceive robots as friends, companions, and even confidants.
Welcome, Dr. Kaku.
Glad to meet you,
Asimo.
I'll show you to the table.
My pleasure.
It's no surprise that the most advanced humanoid robot, Asimo, has been developed here in Japan.
Thank you for making time in your busy schedule to visit us.
No problem.
I'll bring you something to drink.
While Asimo can recognize obstacles and pre-registered faces, most of what it says and does is pre-programmed.
Please take a seat.
Okay, I will.
Please excuse me.
And yet, Asimo has one very important skill. It can walk and move like a human.
I stopped walking.
We take it for granted that we can walk. We don't even think about it. In fact, it's an extremely complex task.
It took the engineers at Honda 20 years of research to achieve Asimo's human-like movements.
I realized that 5-10 years ago, a robot that could walk with this sophistication was beyond reach.
Because Asimo's looks and moves are so strikingly similar to a human, I don't see in it just a machine.
I came for delivery.
Well, thank you.
I brought you orange juice. Mm-hmm.
I know Asimo is a machine.
Thank you so much.
But I find myself relating to it as though it was a real person.
We tend to anthropomorphize things closest to us. For example, recently, my wife and I bought a Roomba. You know, one of these robot vacuum cleaners that cleans your floor automatically. And I began to notice that my wife's attitude toward the machine began to change with time. All of a sudden, she began to call it an affectionate name. And she began to say, "Don't work the robot so hard. Let the poor thing rest. Give it a break." As if it was a real person. As if it was some kind of pet or even a baby.
The more lifelike the machine, the more we will develop an emotional bond with it. And the more we will tend to interact with it. Yet what will happen when, increasingly, the machines interact with us? This is the world's largest robot museum in the Japanese city of Nagoya. Some of the robots on display here are specially designed to foster an emotional bond with humans.
This is the Sony Aibo, in other words, RoboPet. The Sony Aibo can register about 6 different emotions like hunger, distress, pain. When you want to pet the dog, it registers pleasure. You pet it on its back, you tickle its ears, or you tickle its chin. Kimochi.
And when it runs out of electricity, it shows that it's hungry.
So the question is, are humans going to be obsolete very soon, like some people claim? How smart is the world's smartest robot anyway? Well, let me tell you the answer. Asimo, the world's smartest robot, has the collective wisdom and intelligence of a cockroach, a stupid cockroach, a retarded, stupid, lobotomized, dumb cockroach. You know how long it took to set up that scene? 3 hours. 3 agonizing hours. Asimo is a tape recorder. You cannot gossip with it. You cannot joke with it. It has no common sense. It's basically pre-scripted. And, you know, these robots will be great nurses, great cooks, butlers maybe, but never at the level of a human, at least not yet. In the coming decades, we hope to make these robots as smart as maybe a mouse. Maybe even a rabbit. For the TV series, we went to Livermore National Laboratory and photographed Blue Gene. Blue Gene is the 4th largest computer on the planet Earth. It occupies about 1/4 acre. It is the 4th largest computer in the world. And how smart is it? Blue Gene was able to mimic the thought processes of a mouse for 1 second. For 1 second, it had mouse dreams, dreaming of cheese. That's how complicated 10 million neurons are in a mouse. Our brain has 100 billion neurons inside it, as many stars as in the Milky Way galaxy. So, and if you go to Japan and see these robots wave at you, greeting you at the department store, realize that these robots can barely walk around the room. And so just remember that we have a long ways to go before robots are as smart as a dog or a cat. Decades after that, maybe as smart as a monkey. And decades after that, maybe they'll have some emotions.
At MIT, we're beginning to program some robots that can smile, interact with you, but for the most part, they are as smart as a cockroach. So then the next question is, well, here's the governor of California in a very bad mood. You definitely don't want to get on the wrong side of the governor of California. But I figure that by the end of this century, more or less, when they do approach the intelligence of a monkey, at that point we should put a chip in their brain just to shut them off if they become murderous. So we have decades to go before we have to worry about the Terminator. And now let me say a few things about time travel, because this gets us into what I do for a living. My day job is to work on what I think is the most fantastic theory of all time, possibly the crowning achievement of 2,000 years of investigation into the nature of matter ever since the Greeks asked the question, what is matter made of? And what can you do with string theory? In principle, you can answer the question, what happens if you go backwards in time and meet your teenage mother as a young girl and she falls in love with you? Well, if your teenage mother falls in love with you, you're in deep doo-doo. So how do we resolve these questions? Well, believe it or not, string theory has a possibility. These are what are called wormholes. Any fan of Doctor Who knows about these shortcuts through space and time. But the first wormhole was actually introduced by a professor right here at Oxford University. 150 years ago, there was a professor of mathematics at Oxford University who understood these things. Mathematicians call them multiply connected spaces. And so he wrote a book about them, the first book in the English language about multiply connected spaces. Who can tell me? You almost know. Who was this professor of mathematics at Oxford University who wrote the first book about wormholes in the English language? Anybody? It was Professor Charles Dodson. He could not write under his own name, so he created a fake name called Lewis Carroll. The book is Through the Looking Glass, and it is Alice in Wonderland. He was a mathematician. He understood that spaces can be connected via a looking glass. We now call them wormholes. He called them looking glasses. Queen Victoria was so enchanted by Alice in Wonderland that she wrote Professor Dodgson here at Oxford a letter saying, please, please, please give me your next book, which he did. It was a treatise on higher mathematics that he sent to Queen Victoria. Now let me say a few more things. Let me just say a few things about time travel. I just have a few minutes. Some of you have seen the latest Star Trek movie, and the whole movie revolves around this paradox. What happens if you go backwards in time and change the past? Well, if you think you're so smart, listen to this. I'm now going to give you the mother of all time travel stories. Listen carefully now. The year is 1945. It is a dark and stormy night. A stranger comes in from the darkness carrying a beautiful baby girl that he drops off at an orphanage and disappears. Well, the nuns find this baby girl the next day. They don't know what to do with her, so they call her Jane. And Jane grows up wondering, who is my mother? Who is my father, my brother, my sister? I was left as a foundling on the doorstep. Well, when Jane is 17 years old, she falls in love. But, you know, it was not meant to be. She and her boyfriend quarrel a lot, and her boyfriend stomps off into the darkness. But it's a very sad story. Jane finds out she's pregnant and abandoned. Her boyfriend has left her. 9 months later, she delivers a beautiful baby girl, but someone that very night breaks open the window of the hospital, kidnaps Jane's baby girl, and disappears. And it's even worse than this. Jane is bleeding very rapidly. It's a very bad delivery. The doctors say that she might die. They have to perform an experimental emergency operation on Jane. They have to change Jane into Jim. Well, Jim wakes up the next day with this huge headache, left as a foundling on the doorstep of an orphanage, grows up as Jane, falls in love and is abandoned, someone kidnaps her baby girl, and now she's not even a female anymore. She's a male. Well, Jim gets into fist fights. Anytime someone asks him, who are you, Jim? Where'd you come from? Who is your mother, your father, your brother, your sister? Well, poor Jim is once again stone drunk on the bottom of a bar. But this time, something happens, a miracle.
The bartender comes up to him and says, "Wake up, Jim, wake up. I'm really a time traveler. Come into my machine and let us find out who really is Jane/Jim. Well, they go back into the past. And poor Jim is a little bit disoriented in the past. But then suddenly, he meets this beautiful 17-year-old girl. And it's love at first sight. But you know, it was not meant to be. They quarrel a lot, and Jim stomps off into the darkness. But then he finds out that his girlfriend is pregnant. And he says, oh my God, I got to take responsibility. So 9 months later, he goes to the hospital, breaks open the window of the hospital, goes in the hospital and kidnaps his own precious baby girl. And he goes back into the time machine, back, way back into the past, to give the best education possible for his dear baby girl. Well, it is now 1945. It is a dark and stormy night. Jim comes in from the darkness carrying his own precious baby girl that he drops off at an orphanage. Well, the nuns pick up this baby girl the next day. The nuns don't know what else to call her, so they call her Jane. And Jane grows up wondering, who is my mother, my father, my brother, my sister? I was left as a foundling on the doorstep of this orphanage. Well, Jim finally says, I got to get together. You know, I don't want to be a drunk all my life. So he decides to join the Time Travelers Corps. And Jim has many famous exploits in the annals of time. Well, now Jim is an old man. And he says to himself, I want one final mission in the hallmarks of time. I want to put on a mustache and a wig, and I want to go backwards in time for my final mission to impersonate a bartender, to meet a certain barroom drunk who just got into a fist fight because someone said, who are you, Jim? Where did you come from? So who can tell me now, who is Jane's mother, father, son, grandfather, grandson, great-great-grandfather, great-great-granddaughter? Who is Jane? Jane is a family tree unto herself. Can you imagine a family get together and they get into a food fight and someone says, you did this to me. No, you did that to yourself. Well, think about this. Now let me just wrap up by saying that, yes, certain things may take centuries to achieve. Time travel, warp drive. We have a theory of warp drive. We have a theory of time travel. But they may take centuries. So let's talk about the future. When we physicists look at the future, we don't look at little green men from outer space as a model. We look for type 1, type 2, and type 3 civilizations in outer space. A type 1 civilization has the energy of an entire planet. They control the weather. They control the ocean. About 100 years from now, type 1 planetary civilization, like Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers. Type 2 is stellar. They control the power of a few stars, like the Federation of Planets. The Federation of Planets of Star Trek is a typical type 2 civilization. Then there is a galactic civilization, type 3, which has the power of a galaxy. So this is type 1. A type 1 civilization like Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon, planetary. That's where we are headed today. What is the internet? The internet is the beginning of a type 1 telephone system. What is English? English is the beginning of a type 1 language. What is the European Union? The beginning of a type 1 economy. What is rock and roll? The beginning of a type 1 culture. Oh my God, rock and roll. This is type 1. They've colonized the asteroid belt, but not much more than that. This is type 2. A type 2 civilization controls the power of a star. Even the death of their own home star, a supernova, is not enough to stop the Federation of Planets and Star Trek. And this is type 3, a galactic civilization. They send probes throughout the galaxy, self-replicating von Neumann probes to colonize the galaxy. And what are we on the scale? We are type 0. We get our energy from dead plants. Well, I gave this talk at the planetarium years ago, and a little boy comes up to me, 10 years of age, a real pest. He comes up to me and he yanks on my pants and he says, Professor, you're wrong. There's type 4. I look down on this little 10-year-old kid and I say to him, shut up, kid. Why don't you go play in traffic? There's a nice intersection over there. Well, he wouldn't go away, this pesky little 10-year-old kid. And he kept insisting, you're wrong. There's type 4. And I said, look, kid, There are planets, stars, and galaxies. Any extraterrestrial civilization will become planetary first, then they will colonize a few stars, and then they'll colonize a galaxy. There's nothing beyond galactic. And he said, you're wrong. There's the power of the continuum. Now, who's a true blue Star Trek fan? What is the only civilization that marshals the power of the continuum? Anybody? The Q. If you did not understand what just transpired, get with the program. The movie is playing out there in the movie theaters right now. Find out about the Q, the power of the continuum. Well, you know, our universe is dying. And one day we may have to use the full power of our lasers to create an escape valve, a lifeboat. The latest data shows that our universe will undergo a big freeze, maybe trillions of years from now. It's awful. Why bother to study for final exams tomorrow, knowing that it's all for naught, that all intelligent life will die when we hit the big freeze? Or, as that other great philosopher of the Western world once said, Woody Allen, he once said, quote, eternity is an awful long time, especially toward the end. I say, perhaps one day we should escape. Perhaps escape into the 11th dimension. Perhaps there is a way to escape the death of the universe itself, and that is to leave the universe. Or what Stephen Hawking has said, create a baby universe. This is the power of string theory, that we can dream. Dream about the impossible. Now, let me end on this note. First of all, our Earth also radiates. We radiate radio and television. And so the question is, how come they don't visit us? Well, surrounding the Earth, there is a sphere, 50 light years in radius, expanding at the speed of television, containing the finest of our cultural archives, the noblest achievements of the human creative spirit, like I Love Lucy, and now joined by the immortal classics, Beavis and Butthead Part 2, and Dumb and Dumber Part 2. And any star within 50 light years of the Earth will pick up our cultural emissions, and they'll be convinced there is no intelligent life on the Earth. Maybe that's why they don't visit us. And a final remark. I'd like to dedicate my comments to my childhood hero, Albert Einstein. I spoke at the Einstein Centennial recently, and this is my favorite Einstein story, and then I'll throw it open and sign books. When Einstein was an old man, he was tired of giving the same talk over and over again. So one day his chauffeur came up to him and he said, Professor, I'm really a part-time actor. I've heard your talk so many times, I've memorized it. Why don't we switch places? I will put on a mustache and a wig and I'll be the great Einstein and you can just take a rest and be my chauffeur. Well, Einstein loved the practical joke, so they switched places. So the chauffeur gave brilliant talks. He memorized the whole talk, and it went very smoothly until one day, a mathematician asked a very, very difficult question. And Einstein thought, oh, the game is up. But then the chauffeur said, that question is so elementary that even my chauffeur here will answer it for you. Thank you very much.